From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Terrence Blanchard grew up thinking he'd play football for a living. Playing trumpet was a much better fit. But Blanchard says the last thing he wants to do is play the trumpet like a trumpet.
And I just started trying to emulate the voice on the trumpet. That's been my thing, you know. To me, the voice is the ultimate instrument in the world.
Early on, the titans of jazz became fans, including Miles Davis.
He said, "Terrence." And, you know, and we talked for a second. And when I was leaving, he said, "Keep doing what you're doing."
Terrence. Hear Terrence Blanchard in his own voice after the break. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. When the microphone switches on, some people freeze. But Terrence Blanchard relaxes. Blanchard does his best thinking when the mic is on, and Blanchard is in a hurry to get his ideas recorded. That might explain why he's so prolific and why he's so good. Terrence Blanchard is a Grammy Award-winning trumpeter and composer. He's comfortable in jazz and orchestral music, as a sideman and as the main attraction. He also shines playing bossa nova, mambos, and gospel. Blanchard has released armfuls of albums and appeared on more than 50 movie soundtracks. In 2013, he released a CD of original music called Magnetic. And just a few weeks later, Opera Theater of St. Louis unveiled Blanchard's first opera, called Champion.
At the end of the day, there's only you, only me. At the end of the day, as the sun dies in the west, and the light falls to rest on the earth.
Terrence Blanchard joins us here in New Orleans at Marigny Recording Studios. Thanks so much for coming out.
Thanks for having me, Gwen.
It's really a pleasure to have you.
It's an honor for me.
You know, I was laughing earlier because I tell everyone I'm going to the Terrence Blanchard School of Music, which includes listening to more records than I think anybody has ever made.
Wow.
You know, short of Beethoven, I guess.
Okay. Okay. That's great company to be in.
Great company.
Yeah.
So there is so much to talk about. So I'm just going to plunge in.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to start with the beginning of your professional career.
Mm.
Okay. So my understanding, and tell me if I'm wrong, is you, Terrence Blanchard, were born in New Orleans, born and raised in New Orleans. You went to Rutgers University up in New Jersey.
Yes.
And then while at Rutgers, you started playing with the Lionel Hampton Orchestra, right?
Yes, 1980.
How did you, I know you're a talented man, we stipulate that, but okay. How in the heck did you end up like rolling with Lionel Hampton?
Well, it was one of those things, you know. A friend of mine used to say, what's the definition of luck is when preparation meets opportunity.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's one of those things where I applied to Rutgers. They didn't have any housing. So 2 weeks before school, I stayed with the guy who was running the jazz department at the time. His name was Paul Jeffries. And Paul was playing with Lionel Hampton. So he was going up to do a gig with Hamp. And he said, hey, man, just bring your horn. And when long story short, we get there, I'm hanging out with the guys in the band. And then Hamp says, hey, he rolls up behind me and he goes, hey, champ, let me hear you play blues with the piano player.
No way.
Yeah, and I go, okay. So I started playing the blues and he says, man, I'm gonna hire you. I want you to join the band. So the next week I was going on the road. And it was perfect because when I was in school at Rutgers, he only worked on the weekends.
Oh.
So, you know, Friday after class, I was headed up to New York. We'd go and we'd drive some plays Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday morning. I had this creative writing class, you know, Monday morning that I would skip every now and then. But the guy who ran the class, he was really cool, big jazz fan. He knew what I was doing. So he made me write papers about my experiences.
That's so smart.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing is, you're rolling with the king. I mean, if you had said, okay, my friend and I, we're going to go up to New York on the weekends and we're going to try to get gigs or we're going to get gigs,
right.
That doesn't impress anybody.
No,
but when you say
work.
Lionel Hampton, the king of the vibraphone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that's what it was.
Do you remember those gigs? I mean, do you remember any particular songs that you loved playing with Lionel Hampton's orchestra?
The thing that I remember the most were the experiences of meeting all of these great musicians.
Yeah.
You know, playing with Curtis Fuller, great trombonist, Frankie Dunlap, who played with Monk and Sonny Rollins on the drums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being on the bus with those guys. Those are the memories that I have more than the gigs, actually.
That I can imagine, yeah, because I would imagine that these are the fellows who are teaching you how to be a jazz musician on the road.
Well, the first thing I learned is that everybody has their spot on the bus. That's the first thing you learn.
Where did Mr. Hampton sit?
Well, he sat up front, but every time I sat down, you know, my first trip, every time I sat down, yeah, hey, young fella, that's my spot. Move to another spot. Hey, young fella, you got to move. I want it back by the bathroom. You know what I mean?
Oh, no. And
but
that terrible
cool.
cleanser smell,
it was cool.
You know?
It was cool.
That's no good. That
no,
will bring you the
wasn't.
Blues, actually.
It wasn't, but it made you practice so you can get another spot on the bus.
And where do you sit now?
Well, now I have my own bus, so it's all good. It's all good. Yeah, it's all good.
But then shortly after leaving the Lionel Hampton Orchestra, you ended up with Art Blakey.
Yeah.
With the Jazz Messengers, which is, of course, like, this is the gold standard of training for so many.
Oh, yeah.
So many artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to dwell too much on the past, but I do want to mention that nobody just walks into these organizations. I mean,
right.
You essentially, you know what I mean, did the equivalent of taking AP Jazz.
Well, you know,
you know,
you're
in
right.
New Orleans,
well,
right?
Well, the thing is, you know, NOCA, I went to the arts high school here, New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts. NOCA prepared us in a great way. You know, it was a great experience going to NOCA because I felt like we got the type of tutelage that prepared us for all of this. As a matter of fact, I was so prepared that when I got to college, you know, my trumpet instructor, Bill Fielder, when he would have other things to do, he would say, Blanchard, take over the class.
Oh.
And he would have me teach the class. So that's all because of what I learned here in New Orleans at the
New Orleans.
The New Orleans Center
for Creative Arts. And so then you became like a little maestro, and so you ended up in New Jersey, and rolling again with the Jazz Messengers.
The thing that was interesting about it, you know, Wynton had been in the band for a couple of years.
Wynton Marsalis.
Right. And he was getting, him and Branford, they were leaving to go do their own thing. And we had open auditions. And Donald Harrison and myself went down with some other musicians.
Donald Harrison, the great saxophonist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we won the spots. The very next week, we played in Chicago. I'll never forget it. And then like a couple of weeks after that, we were in Europe for 10 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was 19
sort of
years old.
Swept up into like a tornado, really.
Oh, definitely. Thing, but it was something that was so exciting you couldn't really appreciate it at first because there was so much happening. I mean, I go from, you know, being in New Orleans, then playing with Lionel Hampton, then being in Europe with Art Blakey, meeting Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, you know, already knew Clark Terry from here, you know, Freddie Hubbard,
yes.
You know, all of these people, Eddie Lockjaw Davis, Jimmy Heath, James Moody, you know, these are all the musicians that I was meeting when I was 19, 20 years old.
My goodness. And the thing is, I mean, the Jazz Messengers, I mean, this is a group that was together for decades.
Yes.
And in that time, so many young artists came to maturity in that group. You know,
oh,
so
yeah.
For instance, you know, we're talking Wayne Shorter, as you mentioned, you know, mm-hmm. the great tenor sax player, Freddie mm-hmm. Hubbard, the
oh,
great
yeah.
trumpet player, obviously Wynton Marsalis and Donald Harrison on saxophone.
And some people you may not think of, Chuck Mangione.
Wow.
Lee Morgan.
Lee Morgan went
yeah.
through. I didn't know he was with the Jazz
oh,
Messengers.
Yeah. Woody Shaw.
Yeah.
I mean, so the list is endless. I mean, and the funny thing about it, too, we all used to say this. Whenever you get two people who play with Art Blakey in the same room, eventually the conversation is going to turn towards Art Blakey throughout the night.
It
happens
yeah.
all the time. You know, because somebody's going to say, hey, man, you remember when Boo used to say blah, 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 blah? And then you're off and running into a whole other type of conversation.
Well, that's where our conversation is heading, actually, because I want to know about Art Blakey. I mean, here's a guy, mm-hmm. ferocious drummer,
mm-hmm.
Very strong personality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Liked young people,
yes.
which is extraordinary, you know, I think. I mean, simply because mm-hmm. there are so many musicians who just don't have time for young people.
Well,
you know?
Art's whole thing was when I first joined the band, I mean, the first thing he said to me, he said, listen, man, you're in this band to learn how to become a band leader. He said, I don't want you to leave this band and join anybody else's band.
Mm.
He said, we're trying to develop band leaders to have this music grow, you know, and he said, that's my mission in life. And you can tell that's what it was because he always used to make a joke when he'd introduce the bands. He'd say, I stick with the young people. And he said, when these get too old, I'm going to get me some younger ones. but I got to tell you, one of the most profound things he said to me was, well, it was a number of things, but this was a profound experience. When we went to him and we told him that we were leaving the band, Donald Harrison, Mo Gramella, and myself, we sat Art down and talked to him. We told him we appreciated everything that he had done, but it was time for us to move on. He thanked us for
wow.
being in the band. And then he said, well, you got to help me find some younger musicians. He said, because we have to keep this thing rolling of churning out these young band leaders. And you have to give him credit, man. I mean, he was a guy who was committed to a cause.
Absolutely.
And, look what happened as a result of it, all
right.
of these musicians. And he was a character, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, there was a lot of things that was very funny about Art Blakey.
That's what I want to know. I mean, you called him Boo? Did you really call him Boo?
Well, yeah, because his Muslim name was Abdullah ibn Buhayna. So people call him Boo for short. Yeah, that was it. And he would tell you, he said, Art Blakey's my stage name. You know, he said, my real name is Abdullah. which was something in itself. I mean, while he was a guy who was really interested in creating all of these band leaders, he was also a guy who was very socially active and socially aware, you know, and he instilled all of that into us. I remember he used to tell me all the time, he said, listen, man, you never speak above your audience. He said, you never speak beneath them. He said, you speak right to them.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, how does that idea, how do you reconcile that with a Miles Davis, for instance, who was not one who was ever considered to be a friend of the audience well, in live performance? You know what?
In a way, he was, you know, because the way that I take that whole statement, what I take it to mean is that you need to be yourself. You don't try to be something that you're not. Don't try to give an audience what you think an audience wants, mm-hmm. you know? And the thing you have to do is have to be brave in your convictions about what it is you feel musically and accept the consequences.
Ah.
You know what I mean? So the thing with Miles is Miles was just being who he was. Miles understood the whole thing of drama. You know what I mean? So while people would sit there and say, oh, he wasn't a friend of an audience. No, he knew how to create drama.
Okay.
He knew how to create suspense. You know what I mean? And we take it in these other ways. But when I got a chance to meet him, you know, he was the funniest dude I've ever met, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he'd seen me play on a television broadcast of the Jacksonville Jazz Festival. And while I was in Italy, some journalist walked up to him and asked him about young trumpet players. So he mentioned my name as
nice.
One of the guys that he liked. So I'm coming out of the hotel in Perugia, Italy. And like four or five journalists run up to me and they said, well, what do you think about what Miles Davis said? And I said, well, first of all, tell me what he said.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the first thing. Let's get that straight. But then I got a chance to meet him on that same festival.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Terrence. And, you know, and we talked for a second. And when I was leaving, he said, keep doing what you're doing.
Mm.
But the funny part about him was, what was it, a few months later, a couple of years later, Donald Harrison and myself, we opened up for him in Spain.
Wow.
The next day we were flying to, I think, Madrid or something like that, on the same plane.
Yeah.
So we get the baggage claim. And I walk up to Miles, and Miles looks at me and goes, man, what you doing here? I said, man, I opened up for you last night.
Exactly.
And I can't tell you what he said, but you know.
He said, that was you?
I said, yeah, man.
He said, oh, man, I didn't know. Did you record it?
He was hilarious. He was a funny dude.
That is funny.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, there is some kind of strange irony opening up for the guy in Spain, for the guy who wrote Sketches of Spain.
Oh, well, look, the one that got me was, it's like, no, opening up for the guy whose stuff you play, you stole from him. It's like, you know, you sit there and you go, oh, I can't play that. All right, can't do that. Damn.
He'll know.
Right, right. Well, the whole night was like that. You know what
yeah.
I mean? It's like, oh, man. You know, because Miles was my dude, man. I listened to those records all the time growing up.
Sketches of Spain brings back memories. That was Miles Davis. Before that, we heard Fire Waltz from Terrence Blanchard and Donald Harrison. Coming up, Blanchard risks it all on his lips after the break.
¶¶
This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're listening to the Terrence Blanchard Quintet and one of its original songs called Over There. Let's listen together and enjoy every note. Have a very specific tone.
Thank you.
I mean, and I say that. I mean, I'm a music lover. I'm not a musician. Mm-hmm. But when I hear you, I can recognize you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because you've got this a particular way of playing. There's something very, and I mean this in the best sense. Mm-hmm. There's something very agile and light about it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like when you are playing straight ahead. Mm-hmm. Jazz, for instance, you mm-hmm. know, you are flying.
Well, thank you for that. You know, what it is for me is that it's a bunch of things all that have been put together. I mean, I grew up listening to opera in the house. My father was an opera lover, so I've had an attraction to the voice just in general.
Yes.
So that transfers into the jazz world of loving people like Sarah Vaughan, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, Billy Eckstein, all of those great jazz vocalists.
Sure.
And then you turn around and you play the trumpet. And one of the things I always talk about with playing the trumpet is the same thing Art Blakey used to talk about playing the drums. He used to say the easiest thing to do is to play the drums loud. And for me, the easiest thing to do with the trumpet is to play it like a trumpet.
Yes.
And one of the things that I've never wanted to do is to have that quality. I did this album with Yvonne Linz a number of years ago, and there was one moment when we started trading.
Right. And I want to just tell the listeners, though, Yvonne Linz is the great Brazilian musician,
yes.
right? Pianist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all you did a beautiful album with him, The Heart.
The Heart Speaks. You know, I'm trading with a voice, and I kept feeling like I was playing a bugle.
Yes.
And that was a moment in time. It's one of those moments of learning, you know.
Epiphany.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started trying to emulate the voice on the trumpet. That's been my thing. Because when you listen to me, the voice is the ultimate instrument in the world.
Yes. I want you to talk a little bit about your lips.
Oh, okay. Embouchure.
Yes, embouchure.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because you did a wonderful album with the Jazz Messengers, actually, New York Scene.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That won a Grammy back in 1984.
Yes.
That was fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
And particularly your rendition of the song Tenderly.
Yeah.
Thank you. That album was, as I mentioned, was released in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Then some years later, this is after you actually started doing a little bit of film work where you were the wing, what is it, the wind beneath Denzel Washington's wings.
Okay.
In the Mo Better Blues film,
I'm going to tell him that next time I see him.
And, but you started having lip problems.
Yeah. Well, I'd been having them all along. You know, I just knew how to overcome it and compensate for it. What happened was I had started to realize creatively I wanted to play a certain way, and my technical ability was prohibiting me from doing that. So
what were you doing?
Well, I had learned how to play with my bottom lip rolled over my bottom teeth.
Oh, and that's not good?
No, it's a big no-no. But the thing is, my instructors never noticed it because I was producing, you know.
Right.
I was making records and I had a career. But when I figured out what it was, I said, you know what? Either I can continue like this and have a limited career, or I can make a change.
Yeah.
You know, and it was rough. I got to tell you, it was really rough because when I changed at first, I couldn't get a sound out of the trumpet.
Really?
No.
What does that mean, can't get a sound out of a trumpet?
No tone, just air.
Really?
Really.
That must be very frightening.
Oh, and I had a kid. I just had a kid. And yeah, no, it was rough. But the thing is, I kept saying, you know, either I'm going to do this or I'm not. And once I made the decision to do it, I just stuck to my guns. And it was really rough because I was still working. So there was a moment when I first started where I would actually practice with the new embouchure, and then I would play the gigs with the old embouchure, which sounds kind of crazy.
Just, yeah, well, I understand that.
Yeah, but then there came a moment in time where I just had to commit to the new thing. And when I did that, it was hard.
Okay, well, we're going to listen to just a little bit of this song that you did for the Mo Better Blues soundtrack called Again Never.
You know what I have to tell you? That's exactly when I changed.
So that's post-New Embouchure?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Amazing. That is a gorgeous song.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, this is Music Inside Out. We're talking to the great Terrence Blanchard, who can do anything that needs doing in music. He plays trumpet, he leads his own quintet, he can write music for opera, for movie soundtracks, you name it. So let me ask you, Terrence Blanchard, where did you grow up in New Orleans?
I grew up mostly in Pontchartrain Park. For a small period of time, I'd lived further east, you know, out on Rosemont.
I'm from Pontchartrain Park. I still live there. I live.
Get out of here.
Yeah, you know, Mithra and Press. Yeah. That's where I live, right by the bus stop.
Really?
Yeah.
I lived on Odin Street right by Providence.
No.
Yes,
literally grew up within two blocks of each other.
Yes, I know that. Wow, that's freaky.
I feel privileged.
Get out. That's funny. Yeah, I mean, that's where I played football there.
Yeah, in the park.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we all grew up there. Troy Henry, Wendell Pierce. The thing that was interesting about growing up in Pontchartrain Park was, which is sad to say today because we don't have the same type of middle class, it was an area where everybody's families were trying to do better. Everybody's families were trying to give their kids the best education they could give them.
Well, you know, we should actually give a little context because there are people who are listening from Canada and all these other places, right? But Pontchartrain Park is billed as the first neighborhood that was actually built for quote-unquote middle-class black residents in the country.
Yes.
And so this was a neighborhood that began in the 1950s, was built in the 1950s. A lot of people came in, built by a lot of, a lot of the original residents were longshoremen. They worked for the post office. They were teachers.
Right. And a lot of guys bought their homes with the GI Bill.
Yes. Yeah. The GI Bill. And it had like an extraordinarily high ownership rate out there.
Yes.
You know, so people were, you know.
Built around a golf course.
Built around a golf course.
That was designed by an African American.
By a black man.
You know what's funny about it today? You know, I never even thought about that, man, that we lived in an area that was built around a golf course. You know, first of all, because I never golfed, but, you know, but I just never thought about that. It just didn't occur to me. But the thing that did occur to me was we grew up in a community where because my football coach lived around by you.
Yeah.
You know, there was Coach Gray. Mm-hmm. He lived over there on Mithra, and then Coach Mack. And the thing that was interesting about it, these were all people who were engaged in the future of the youth.
Yes.
And it was a community effort. You know, I remember one time when I was a little kid, man, I was trying to smoke. I thought I was going to be cool. Thought I was going to smoke. And I was walking down Press Drive, and I saw somebody else's mom and just totally freaked. I went, oh, my God. And I think about that today, and I think about, you know, how great that was that everybody was so involved in everybody else's kids' lives.
It's true.
And when you talk about it takes a village, we grew up in that village.
So your dad was Joseph Blanchard?
You know what's funny about that? I've known him all my life as Oliver Joseph Blanchard.
Oliver Joseph.
And the day that he passed, when we got his birth certificate, it said Joseph Oliver Blanchard. It's one of those Louisiana stories.
You know, when I did notice that you have like a little company or something that you call Oliver.
Joseph Oliver.
Joseph Oliver.
Music.
Music. And I thought that it was related to Joe King Oliver.
I know a lot of people.
You know what I mean? The great cornetist,
exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
And but no, that's your dad.
It's my dad.
Love it. Yeah. Love it. And so your dad was a baritone singer, loved opera. Mm-hmm. What kinds of operas did he love to listen to at home?
All of the classics. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Carmen.
Carmen.
Yeah, definitely.
Bizet.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, definitely. That was probably, you know, one of the most played recordings in the house. And I remember my dad had those old RCA Victor recordings.
Yes, records, you know, the heavy ones.
Yes, exactly. That we weren't allowed to touch.
No.
No, yeah. You would hear door slamming in the house because, you know.
Nobody wanted to hear it.
Yeah, because everybody was like, oh, there he goes. Boom, you know, boom. It was pretty funny.
And so your mom, I mean, was she a particular music lover as well? What kind of music did she like?
No. My mom loves spiritual music, and my mom loves music in general.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a miracle that I have musical talent. And she knows. You know, my mom is sweet, and my father made sure I put my mind towards music.
Smart man. What did he do for a living?
My father sold insurance by day
mm-hmm.
and worked as a hospital orderly at night.
Really?
Yeah, he had two jobs, and he was very devoted. You know, I mean, My father was a workaholic. You know, he would come home and he would literally go to bed and sleep for a few hours and then get up and go to work at night. And he did that every night. And my dad was brilliant with numbers. He used to have these little number games we would play as when I was a kid, you know, and he just had that type of mind. One of the things that we always used to do as a father-son thing, before he would go to work at night, he would wake me up and we'd watch The Honeymooners.
Norton, don't you have to go upstairs and have supper?
I already ate. Well, aren't you going to be a little uncomfortable sitting here watching Alice and I eat? Oh, thank you, Ralph. You put it that way, huh? I'll be glad to say.
All right, Alice, I'll have a little order of spaghetti and meatballs, light on a marinara, heavy on a shoot, one with a feather in it, hold the meal.
And then I'd have to go to bed, and then he'd go to work.
You and your dad in The Honeymooners.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a great moment.
Yeah, it was.
Well, so, you know, have there ever been any songs that you have composed yourself with your father in mind?
Just about my entire career.
Really?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, when I started working on the opera, I kept him close to me, you know, and the entire time in my heart, at least, you know. And I remember before he passed, one of the biggest thrills that I could have ever gotten and given him was the first time I worked on a film with Spike Lee. We were doing Jungle Fever.
Yes.
And I got a chance to fly him up to New York and have him come to one of the sessions. You know, forget that I was scared to death because it was my first film. But, you know, we walked into the studio and it was a huge thing for him to see, you know, a 60-piece orchestra. And then for some of it, we had the Harlem Boys Choir there, too.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great gift to give your dad.
It was nice. He was thoroughly impressed.
We're hearing an excerpt from the movie Jungle Fever. This was Terrence Blanchard's first film score, the first of many. Blanchard will be on Music Inside Out again to talk more about the movies. But if you'd like to brush up now, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. Next, Terrence Blanchard and one of the most deadly boxing matches in history. After the break. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins.
Welcome to the fight of the week. I'm Don Dunphy, your ringside commentator.
Main event.
The scene is Madison Square Garden, and the welterweight championship of the world is at stake tonight as Benny Kid Perrette defends against Emil Griffith over 15 rounds or less.
We are hearing tape from March 24th, 1962. That's when boxer Emil Griffith of the U.S. Virgin Islands met Benny the Kid Perrette at Madison Square Garden. They fought for the World Welterweight Championship, and what happened in the ring made history. Benny the Kid Perrette took a terrible beating and died shortly after the match, and Emil Griffith became the only gay man known to have won a boxing championship. That fight is at the center of Terrence Blanchard's new opera titled Champion.
That particular fight was an amazing fight, you know, for a number of reasons. You know, there was this whole notion of Emil being a gay male in the world of boxing and keeping his sexuality close to the vest. People in the boxing world knew about it, but it wasn't something that was widely reported or if reported at all. And Benny Perrette and Emil had fought twice before, each winning a bout. So, you know, they're both trying to gain an edge on each other in this third fight. And in the press conference, you know, Benny called Emil a maricon.
Which is a very bad word.
Right, for a gay male. And it incensed, you know, Emil. I don't know if that was any extra incentive for Emil, but because Emil was just a ferocious fighter. Well, let me back up. In professional boxing, the refs always tell you protect yourself at all times.
Okay.
And it is incumbent upon your opponent to take you out. It's a violent sport.
Yeah.
So there's a moment where Emil hits Benny like 17 times.
17 times in 5 seconds.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Dr. Schiffer's coming over to look at him. Coretta's collapsed from exhaustion from that beating on the ropes. And Dr. Alexander Schiffer, the commission, is trying to get at him.
The ref was a very, very reputable ref.
Mm-hmm.
A very responsible guy, but he's behind...
Behind
Emil.
Emil. Okay. So and Emil has the guy in the corner, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I don't think he could really see that Benny wasn't throwing back.
Okay.
Emil hits him 17 times. And he falls into a coma. He knocks him out. And he falls into the coma for 10 days and he dies. But the thing that some people don't talk about is what led up to that fight. Was
okay.
That Benny Perrette was the type of fighter where he would take a bunch of punches to get close to you to throw one.
Oh, and like Ali Foreman. Like what, rope-a-dope, that rope-a-dope thing.
But it wasn't a rope-a-dope. He didn't cover. He would just take these punches.
Dang.
So when Emil hit Benny, people thought, or a lot of people still theorized that he was damaged from the fight before.
I see.
And shouldn't have been in that fight to begin with.
Well, Norman Mailer wrote about that fight, and he said it was like watching a baseball bat demolish a pumpkin. Oh,
it was something to behold. And it had a huge impact on the world of boxing, because you got to remember, that happened on live television.
That's right, and NBC pulled it, right? They stopped airing boxing.
For 10 years.
Wow.
10 years.
But the thing is, but your opera, and it's called a jazz opera, right? And it's titled Champion.
Well, we call it an opera in jazz.
Sorry, an opera in jazz.
Yeah.
Now, it turns on this fight, this terrible fight, although he had lots of fights, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the fight that troubled him the most, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
But also this man struggled to deal with his sexuality.
Yes.
And this is a guy who had a very long career. I mean, he fought from like the late 50s until the late 70s.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But you tell the story in what they call 10 rounds?
Yeah, what we do with the opera is we decided to tell the opera in 10 rounds. And Emil Griffith, who was suffering from dementia, looks back on his life. That's the way we tell the opera. We start the opera with old Emil. And for each ringing of the bell, for each round, it's a flashback and insight into his life.
Mm.
And what was really brilliant about the way Jim Robinson staged the entire opera is that old Emil walks around the set while he's watching all of these other things happen in his life.
The Opera Theater of St. Louis, which, you know, is responsible for commissioning this work or co-commissioning the work and, mm-hmm. and presenting it, they were gracious enough to send us some tape from the performance.
Good.
And, you know, there are two pieces that I want to listen to with you. One involves an interior conversation that's happening where Emil, as a boxer, a young man, young, beautiful man,
mm-hmm.
you know, he is trying to reconcile the exterior Emil, man who's bound for the Boxing Hall of Fame,
yes.
and the interior Emil, who
right.
is this person who is full of all sorts of desires that he can't articulate.
Right,
you know?
What makes a man a man?
What makes a man a man?
What makes a man a man? What makes a man the man he is? Is it the flesh and bone? Inside, outside? Is it the skin he wears?
I mean, this is such a fundamental question, you know, of
yes.
identity. And it's heartbreaking to hear that man. Tell us who that performer is.
Well, it's Aubrey Ellicott who's playing young Emil there. And it's a moment where, you know, he has to go into this fight. And his trainer is trying to tell him, he said, listen, man, you know, don't listen to what this guy is saying. You know, he's not your friend.
This is the kid, Benny Perrette.
Because prior to this, you know, young Emil is saying, why is he saying these things about me? Why is he doing this? What's going on? So after all of that, he sits down and he said, well, what makes a man? You know, is it the color of his skin? Is it the sound of his voice? You know, is it the way he walks?
Yeah.
All of those things. What makes him strong? What makes him weak inside and outside? Which is that duality that, you know, Emil was dealing with, you know, and some of us still deal with to this day.
And the byplay he has with the character Howie, who is his trainer in the opera, is extraordinary because Howie is trying to tell him the way it is. You know, exactly. And this is a conversation nobody wants to hear. Young people hate these kinds of conversations. I hated it when I was young, you know. I want to tell you about the world. The world is the way, not the world that you want, but the world as it is, you know. Right. And it's a harsh world that this man is describing.
And it was hitting him, you know, with such veracity because of his success.
Yes.
That's the thing. That's the irony of it all, you know. And the Howie Albert character in the opera actually is a combination of a couple of guys, Gil Clancy, who was his trainer, and then this other guy, Howie Albert. So, you know, you have this guy with this immense talent, and he's, you know, still caught up in the whirlwind of being a fighter, being into this whole thing, and still struggling with his sexuality. And then on top of that, people have to tell him and say, well, you have this idealistic view of the world, but that's not what it is. That's not the way it is. This is the reality of life.
Yeah, and there is no more binary situation than the ring. I mean, you either win or you lose, that's it. Who plays Howie?
Howie's been played by a guy named Robert Orth. Great, great, great baritone.
In this world, this other man, he's not your friend. In this world, this other man's the man to break, to bend. You bury him, you lay him in the dirt. That makes you strong. That makes you not afraid. That makes you not weak. Because weak is for women, you hear?
Because weak is for women.
And you should hear what he says right after this.
Well, I'm telling you, I have a bone to pick with Howie.
Oh, you're going to have to. Because right after this, he says, wipe that effing smile off your face.
Wow.
Yes. You know, because, you know, because Emil is like this very excited guy trying to prove to him, no, this is not who I am. And he said, listen, man, this is the real world. This is not about being friends. Mm-hmm. It's not about any of that.
Oh, my goodness. But then after all this work with this collaborative work, I mean, operas are very collaborative entities, you know, and you're dealing with so many. Then at the same time, you've come out with your own album called Magnetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's your voice. You know, obviously it's a quintet, but it's your voice, you know. And the songs are extraordinary. I mean, I'm thinking of Comet and Central Focus. We've come to the end of our time together. So which song would you like to hear?
You know what? Why don't we just play the title track?
Magnetic.
Magnetic, yeah. It's because it's, you know, I became a Buddhist about 6 years ago. And Magnetic, it's all about, you know, just in life, whether you're Christian, no matter what you are, if you have a certain belief, you're always trying to draw these positive experiences to your life, you know, and if you have faith, the practice of your belief will draw that to you. So that's what the whole title of Magnetic is all about.
I love that.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Terrence Blanchard.
Thank you, Gwen. Thanks for having me.
You've been wonderful. Terrence Blanchard joined us here at Marini Recording Studios. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Sean Collins, Jason Rhine, Flawn Williams, and Thomas Pierce. Special thanks this week go to Opera Theater of St. Louis and the musicians of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a full show playlist, go to musicinsideout.org and look for us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Music Inside Out is underwritten by the Historic New Orleans Collection, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.